Side 5, The Three Stigmata of Palmer Eldritch, by Philip K. Dick. Continuing on page 161. 20 years ago, in a hunting accident on Callisto, he had lost the original. This one, of course, was superior in that it provided a specialized variety of interchangeable hands. At the moment, Eldritch made use of the five-finger humanoid manual extremity. Except for its metallic shine, it might have been organic. And he was blind, at least from the standpoint of the natural-born body. But replacements had been made, at the prices which Eldritch could and would pay, that had been done just prior to his prox voyage by Brazilian oculists. They had done a superb job. The replacements, fitted into the bone sockets, had no pupils, nor did any ball move by muscular action. Instead, a panoramic vision was supplied by a wide-angle lens, a permanent horizontal slot running from edge to edge. The accident to his original eyes had been no accident. It had occurred in Chicago, a deliberate acid-throwing attack by persons unknown for equally unknown reasons, at least as far as the public was concerned. Eldritch probably knew. He had, however, said nothing, filed no complaint. Instead, he had gone straight to his team of Brazilian oculists. His horizontally slotted artificial eyes seemed to please him. Almost at once, he had appeared at the dedication ceremonies of the new St. George Opera House in Utah and had mixed with his near peers without embarrassment. Even now, a decade later, the operation was rare, and it was the first time Barney had ever seen the Jensen wide-angle Luxvid eyes. This and the artificial arm, with its enormously variable manual repertory, impressed him more than he would have expected. Or was there something else about Eldritch? "Mr. Myerson," Palmer Eldritch said and smiled. The steel teeth glinted in the weak, cold Martian sunlight. He extended his hand, and automatically Barney did the same. "Your voice," Barney thought. "It originates somewhere other than..." He blinked. The entire figure was insubstantial. Dimly through it, the landscape showed. It was a figment of some sort, artificially produced. And the irony came to him. So much of the man was artificial already, and now even the flesh and blood portions were, too. Is this what arrived home from Prox? Barney wondered. If so, Hepburn Gilbert has been deceived. This is no human being, in no sense whatsoever. "I'm still in the ship," Palmer Eldritch said. His voice boomed from a loudspeaker mounted on the ship's hull. "A precaution, inasmuch as you're an employee of Leo Bolero." The figment hand touched Barney's. He experienced a pervasive coldness slop over to him. Obviously a purely psychological aversion reaction, since nothing was there to produce the sensation. "An ex-employee," Barney said. Behind him now, the others of the hovel emerged. The Shines and Morrises and Regans. They approached like wary children as one by one they identified the nebulous man confronting Barney. "What's going on?" Norm Shine said uneasily. "This is a simulacrum. I don't like it." Standing beside Barney, he said, "We're living on the desert, Myerson. We get mirages all the time. Ships and visitors and unnatural life forms. That's what this is. This guy isn't really here, and neither is that ship part there." Todd Morris added, "They're probably 600 miles away. It's an optical phenomenon. You get used to it." "But you can hear me," Palmer Eldritch pointed out. The speaker boomed and echoed. "I'm here, all right, to do business with you. Who's your hovel team, Captain?" "I am," Norm Shine said. "My card." Eldritch held out a small white card, and reflexively Norm Shine reached for it. The card fluttered through his fingers and came to rest on the sand. At that, Eldritch smiled. It was a cold, hollow smile, an implosion, as if it had drawn back into the man everything nearby, even the thin air itself. Look down at it, Eldritch suggested. Norm Schein bent and studied the card. That's right, Eldritch said. I'm here to sign a contract with your group to deliver to you. Spare us the speech about your delivering what God only promises, Norm Schein said. Just tell us the price. About 1/10 that of the competitor's product, and much more effective. You don't even require a layout. Eldritch seemed to be talking directly to Barney. His gaze, however, could not be plotted because of the structure of the lens apertures. Are you enjoying it here on Mars, Mr. Meyerson? It's great fun, Barney said. Eldritch said, last night, when Alan Fane descended from his dull little satellite to meet with you, what did you discuss? Rigidly, Barney said, business. He thought quickly, but not quite quickly enough. The next question was already blaring from the speaker. So, you do still work for Leo? In fact, it was deliberately arranged to send you here to Mars in advance of our first distribution of Choose E. Why? Have you some idea of blocking it? There was no propaganda in your luggage, no leaflets or other printed matter beyond ordinary books. A rumor, perhaps. Word of mouth. Choose E is, what, Mr. Meyerson? Dangerous to the habitual user? I don't know. I'm waiting to try some of it and see. We're all waiting, Fran Schein said. She carried in her arms a load of truffle skins, clearly for immediate payment. Can you make a delivery right now, or do we have to keep on waiting? I can deliver your first allocation, Eldritch said. A port of the ship snapped open. From it popped a small jet tractor. It sped toward them. A yard away, it halted and ejected a carton wrapped in familiar, plain brown paper. The carton lay at their feet, and then, at last, Norm Schein bent and picked it up. It was not a phantasm. Cautiously, Norm tore the wrappings off. Choosy, Mary Regan said breathlessly. Oh, what a lot! How much, Mr. Eldritch? In toto, Eldritch said. 5 skins. The tractor extended a small drawer, then, precisely the size to receive the skins. After an interval of haggling, the hovelists came to an arrangement. The 5 skins were deposited in the drawer. At once, it was withdrawn, and the tractor swiveled and zipped back to the mothership. Farmer Eldritch, insubstantial and gray and large, remained. He appeared to be enjoying himself, Barney decided. It did not bother him to know that Leo Bolero had something up his sleeve. Eldritch thrived on this. The realization depressed him, and he walked alone to the meager cleared place which was eventually to be his garden. His back to the hovelists and Eldritch, he activated an autonomic unit. It began to wheeze and hum. Sand disappeared into it as it sucked noisily, having difficulty. He wondered how long it would continue functioning, and what one did here on Mars to obtain repairs. Perhaps one gave up. Maybe there were no repairs. From behind Barney, Palmer Eldritch's voice came. Now, Mr. Meyerson, you can begin to chew away for the rest of your life. He turned involuntarily, because this was not a phantasm. The man had finally come forth. That's right, he said, and nothing could delight me more. He continued then, tinkering with the autonomic scoop. Where do you go to get equipment fixed on Mars? He asked Eldritch. Does the UN take care of that? Eldritch said, how would I know? A portion of the autonomic scoop broke loose in Barney's hands. He held it, waited. The piece, shaped like a tire iron, was heavy, and he thought, I could kill him with this, right here in this spot. Wouldn't that solve it? No toxin to produce grand mal seizures, no litigation. But there'd be retaliation from them. I'd outlive Eldritch by only a few hours. But isn't it still worth it? He turned. And then it happened so swiftly that he had no valid concept of it, not even an accurate perception. From the parked ship, a laser beam reached forth, and he felt the intense impact as it touched the metal section in his hands. At the same time, Palmer Eldritch danced back, lithely, bounding upward in the slight Martian gravity. Like a balloon, Barney stared but did not believe. He floated off, grinning with his huge steel teeth, waggling his artificial arm, his lank body slowly rotating. Then, as if reeled in by a transparent line, he progressed in a jerky sine wave motion toward the ship. All at once he was gone. The nose of the ship clamped shut after him. Eldritch was inside, safe. "Why'd he do that?" Norm Shine said, eaten with curiosity, where he and the other hovelist stood. "What in God's name went on there?" Barney said nothing. Shakily, he set the remains of the metal piece down. They were ash-like remnants only, brittle and dry. They crumbled away as they touched the ground. "They got into a hassle," Todd Morris said, Meyerson and Eldritch. "They didn't hit it off, not one bit." "Anyhow," Norm said, "we got the 2Z. Meyerson, you better stay away from Eldritch in the future. Let me handle the transaction. If I had known that because you were an employee of Leo Bolero..." "Former," Barney said reflexively, and resumed his tinkering with the defective autonomic scoop. He had failed in his first try at killing Palmer Eldritch. Would he ever have a chance again? Had he really had a chance just now? The answer to both, he decided, was no. Late that afternoon, the hovelists of Chicken Pox Prospect gathered to chew. The mood was one of tension and solemnity. Scarcely anything was said as the bindles of Chew Z, one by one, were unwrapped and passed around. "Ugh," Fran Shine said, making a face. "It tastes awful." "Haste, schmaste," Norm said impatiently. He chewed then. "Like a decayed mushroom. You sure are right." Stoically, he swallowed and continued chewing. "Gah!" he said, and retched. "To be doing this without a layout," Helen Morris said. "Where will we go? Just anywhere? I'm scared," she said all at once. "Will we be together? Are you positive of that, Norm?" "Who cares?" Sam Regan said, chewing. "Watch me," Barney Meyerson said. They glanced at him with curiosity. Something in his tone made them do as he said. "I put the choosy in my mouth," Barney said, "and did so. You see me doing it, right?" He chewed. "Now I'm chewing it." His heart labored. God, he thought, can I go through with this? "Yeah, we see you," Todd Morris agreed, nodding. "So what? I mean, are you going to blow up or float off like Eldritch or something?" He, too, began on his bindle then. They were all chewing, all seven of them, Barney realized. He shut his eyes. The next thing he knew, his wife was bending over him. "I said," she said, "do you want a second Manhattan or not? Because if you do, I have to request the refrigerator for more cracked ice." "Emily," he said. "Yes, dear," she said tartly. "Whenever you say my name like that, I know you're about to launch in on one of your lectures. What is it this time?" She seated herself on the arm of the couch opposite him, smoothing her skirt. It was the striking blue and white hand-printed Mexican wraparound that he had gotten her at Christmas. "I'm ready," she said. "No lecture," he said. "Am I really that way?" he asked himself. "Always delivering tirades?" Groggily, he rose to his feet. He felt dizzy, and he steadied himself by holding on to the nearby pole lamp. Eyeing him, Emily said, "You're blammed." Blammed? He hadn't heard that term since college. It was long out of style, and naturally Emily still used it. "The word," he said as distinctly as possible, "is now snoogled. Can you remember that? Snoogled." He walked unsteadily to the sideboard in the kitchen where the liquor was. "Snoogled," Emily said and sighed. She looked sad. He noticed that and wondered why. "Barney," she said then, "don't drink so much, okay? Call it bland or fnoogled or anything you want, it's still the same. I guess it's my fault. You drink so much because I'm so inadequate." She wiped briefly with her knuckle at her right eye, an annoying, familiar, tick-like motion. "It's not that you're so inadequate," he said. "It's just that I have high standards." "I was taught to expect a lot from others," he said to himself. "To expect they'd be as reputable and stable as I am, and not sloppily emotional all the time, not in control of themselves." But an artist, he realized, or rather, so-called artist, bohemian, that's closer to it, the artistic life without the talent. He began fixing himself a fresh drink, this one bourbon and water without ice. He poured directly from the bottle of Old Crow, ignoring the shot glass. "When you pour that way," Emily said, "I know you're angry and we're in for it, and I just hate it." "So then leave," he said. "God damn you," Emily said. "I don't want to leave. Couldn't you just..." She gestured with hopeless futility. "Be a little nicer, more charitable or something. Learn to overlook..." Her voice sank almost inaudibly, she said, "my shortcomings." "But," he said, "they can't be overlooked. I'd like to. You think I want to live with someone who can't finish anything they start or accomplish anything socially? For instance, when..." "Ah, the hell with it." What was the use? Emily couldn't be reformed. She was purely and simply a slob. Her idea of a well-spent day was to wallow and putter and fool with a mess of greasy, excretion-like paints, or bury her arms for hours on end in a great crock of wet gray clay. And meanwhile, time was escaping from them. And all the world, including all of Mr. Bolero's employees, especially his pre-fash consultants, grew and augmented themselves, bloomed into maturity. "I'll never be the New York pre-fash consultant," he said to himself. "I'll always be stuck here in Detroit, where nothing, absolutely nothing new, originates." If he could snare the position of New York pre-fash consultant, my life would mean something, he realized. I'd be happy, because I'd be doing a job that made full use of my ability. What the hell else would I need? Nothing else. That's all I ask. "I'm going out," he said to Emily and set down his glass. Going to the closet, he got his coat. "Will you be back before I go to bed?" Mournfully, she followed him to the door of the Connaught, here in building 1113958-4, counting outward from downtown New York, where they had lived 2 years now. "We'll see," he said, and opened the door. In the hallway stood a figure, a tall gray man with bulging steel teeth, dead pupilless eyes, and a gleaming artificial hand extended from his right sleeve. The man said, "Hello, Myerson." He smiled. The steel teeth shone. "Palmer Eldritch," Barney said. He turned to Emily. "You've seen his pics in the homeopaths. He's that incredibly famous big industrialist." Naturally, he had recognized Eldritch, and at once... "Did you want to see me?" he asked hesitantly. It all had a mysterious quality to it, as if it had all somehow happened before, but in another way. "Let me talk to your husband a moment," Eldritch said to Emily in a peculiarly gentle voice. He motioned, and Barney stepped out into the hall. The door shut behind him. Emily had closed it obediently. Now Eldritch seemed grim, no longer gentle or smiling, he said. "Myerson, you're using your time badly. You're doing nothing but repeating the past. What's the use of my selling you choosy? You're perverse. I've never seen anything like it. I'll give you 10 more minutes, and then I'm bringing you back to chickenpox prospects, where you belong. So you better figure out very damn fast what you want, and if you understand anything, finally..." "What the hell," Barney said, "is choosy?" The artificial hand lifted. With enormous force, Palmer Eldritch shoved him, and he toppled. "Hey, Barney said weakly, trying to fight back, to nullify the pressure of the man's immense strength. What? And then he was flat on his back. His head rang, ached. With difficulty, he managed to open his eyes and focus on the room around him. He was waking up. He had on, he discovered, his pajamas. But they were unfamiliar. He had never seen them before. Was he in someone else's conapt, wearing their clothes? Some other man? In panic, he examined the bed, the covers. Beside him, he saw an unfamiliar girl who slept on, breathing lightly through her mouth, her hair a tumble of cotton-like white, shoulders bare and smooth. "I'm late," he said, and his voice came out distorted and husky, almost unrecognizable. "No, you're not," the girl murmured, eyes still shut. "Relax. We can get into work from here in..." She yawned and opened her eyes. 15 minutes, she smiled at him. His discomfort amused her. "You always say that, every morning. Go see about coffee. I've got to have coffee." "Sure," he said, and scrambled out of bed. "Mr. Rabbit," the girl said mockingly, "you're so scared. Scared about me, about your job, and always running." "My God," he said. "I've turned my back on everything." "What everything?" "Emily." He stared at the girl, Ronnie something or other, at her bedroom. "Now I've got nothing," he said. "Oh, fine," Ronnie said with embittered sarcasm. "Now maybe I can say some nice things to you to make you feel good." He said, "And I did it just now, not years ago. Just before Palmer Eldritch came in." "How could Palmer Eldritch come in? He's in a hospital bed out in the Jupiter or Saturn area. The UN took him there after they pried him from the wreck of his ship." Her tone was scornful, and yet there was a note of curiosity in it. "Palmer Eldritch appeared to me just now," he said doggedly. He thought, "I have to get back to Emily." Sliding, stooping, he grabbed up his clothes, stumbled with them to the bathroom, and slammed the door behind him. Rapidly he shaved, changed, emerged, and said to the girl who still lay in bed, "I have to go. Don't be sore at me. I have to do it." A moment later, without having had breakfast, he was descending to the ground-level floor, and after that he stood under the anti-thermal shield, searching up and down for a cab. The cab, a fine, shiny new model, whipped him in almost no time to Emily's Connaught building. In a blur, he paid it, hurried inside, and in a matter of seconds was ascending. It seemed as if no time had passed, as if time had ceased and everything waited, frozen, for him. He was in a world of fixed objects, the sole moving thing. At her door, he rang the buzzer. The door opened, and a man stood there. "Yes?" The man was dark, reasonably good-looking, with heavy eyebrows and carefully combed, somewhat curly hair. He held the morning paper in one hand. Behind him, Barney saw a table of breakfast dishes. Barney said, "You're Richard Knapp." "Yes." Puzzled, he regarded Barney intently. "Do I know you?" Emily appeared wearing a gray turtleneck sweater and stained jeans. "Good heavens, it's Barney," she said to Nat. "My former. Come in." She held the door wide open for him, and he entered the apt. She seemed pleased to see him. "Glad to meet you," Nat said in a neutral tone, starting to extend his hand and then changing his mind. "Coffee?" "Thanks." Barney seated himself at the breakfast table at an unset place. "Listen," he said to Emily. He couldn't wait. It had to be said now, even with Nat present. "I made a mistake in divorcing you. I'd like to remarry you. Go back on the old basis." Emily, in a way which he remembered, laughed with delight. She was overcome, and she went off to get him a cup and saucer, unable to answer. He wondered if she would ever answer. It was easier for her. It appealed to the lazy slob in her just to laugh. Christ, he thought, and stared straight ahead fixedly. Across from him, Nat seated himself and said, "We're married. Did you suppose we were just living together?" His face was dark, but he seemed in control of himself. Barney said, speaking to Emily and not to Nat, "Marriages can be broken. Will you remarry me?" He rose and took a few hesitant steps in her direction. At that moment she turned and calmly handed him his cup and saucer. "Oh, no," she said, still smiling. Her eyes poured over with light, that of compassion. She understood how he felt, that this was not an impulse only. But the answer was still no, and he knew it would always be. Her mind was not even made up. There was to her simply no reality to which he was referring. He thought, "I cut her down once, cut her off, lopped her, with thorough knowledge of what I was doing, and this is the result. I am seeing the bread, as they say, which was cast on the water, drifting back to choke me. Water-soaked bread that will lodge in my throat, never to be swallowed or disgorged, either one. It's precisely what I deserve," he said to himself. "I made this situation." Returning to the kitchen table, he numbly seated himself, sat as she filled his cup. He stared at her hands. "Once these were my wife's," he said to himself, "and I gave it up. Self-destruction. I wanted to see myself die. That's the only possible satisfactory explanation. Or was I that stupid?" No, stupidity wouldn't encompass such an enormity, so complete, a willful... Emily said, "How are things, Barney?" "Oh, hell. Just plain great," his voice shook. "I hear you're living with a very pretty little redhead," Emily said. She seated herself at her own place and resumed her meal. "That's over," Barney said, "forgotten." "Who, then?" Her tone was conversational. "Passing the time of day with me as if I were an old pal or perhaps a neighbor from another apt in this building," he thought. Madness! How can she feel like this? Impossible. It's an act, burying something deeper. Aloud he said, "You're afraid that if you get mixed up with me again, I'll toss you out again. Once burned, twice warned. But I won't. I'll never do anything like that again." In her placid, conversational voice, Emily said, "I'm sorry you feel so bad, Barney. Aren't you seeing an analyst? Somebody said they saw you carrying a psychiatric suitcase around with you." "Dr. Smile," he said, remembering. Probably he had left him at Ronnie Fugate's apt. "I need help," he said to Emily. "Isn't there any way..." He broke off. "Can't the past be altered?" he asked himself. Evidently not. Cause and effect work in only one direction, and change is real. So what's gone is gone, and I might as well get out of here. He rose to his feet. "I must be out of my mind," he said to both her and Richard Nat. "I'm sorry. I'm only half awake. This morning I'm disoriented. It started when I woke up." "Drink your coffee, why don't you?" Nat suggested. "How about some bear's claw to go with it?" The darkness had left his face. He, like Emily, was now tranquil, uninvolved. Barney said, "I don't understand it. Palmer Eldritch said to come here." Or had he? Something like that. He was certain of it. "This was supposed to work out, I thought," he said helplessly. Nat and Emily glanced at each other. "Eldritch is in a hospital somewhere," Emily began. "Something's gone wrong," Barney said. "Eldritch must have lost control. I better find him. He can explain it to me." And he felt panic, mercury swift, fluid, pervasive panic. It filled him to his fingertips. "Goodbye," he managed to say, and started toward the door, groping for escape. From behind him, Richard Nat said, "Wait." Barney turned. At the breakfast table, Emily sat with a fixed, faint smile on her face, sipping her coffee. And across from her, Nat sat facing Barney. Nat had one artificial hand with which he held his fork, and when he lifted a bite of egg to his mouth, Barney saw huge, jutting, stainless steel teeth. And Nat was gray, hollowed out with dead eyes, and much larger than before. He seemed to fill the room with his presence. But it was still Nat, I don't get it, Barney said, and stood at the door, not leaving the apt and not returning. He did as Nat suggested. He waited. Isn't this something like Palmer Eldritch? He asked himself. In pics, he has an artificial limb and steel teeth and Jensen eyes. But this was not Eldritch. It's only fair to tell you, Nat said matter-of-factly, that Emily is a lot fonder of you than what she says suggests. I know because she's told me many times. He glanced at Emily then. You're a duty type. You feel it's the moral thing to do at this point, to suppress your emotions toward Barney. It's what you've been doing all along anyhow. But forget your duty. You can't build a marriage on it. There has to be spontaneity there. Even if you feel it's wrong to... He made a gesture. Well, let's say, deny me. Still, you should face your feelings honestly and not cover them with a self-sacrificing facade. That's what you did with Barney here. You let him kick you out because you thought it was your duty not to interfere with his career. He added, you're still behaving that way, and it's still a mistake. Be true to yourself. And all at once, he grinned at Barney. Grinned, and one dead eye flicked off, as if in a mechanical wink. It was Palmer Eldritch now, completely. Emily, however, did not appear to notice. Her smile had faded, and she looked confused, upset, and increasingly furious. You make me so damn angry, she said to her husband. I said how I feel, and I'm not a hypocrite, and I don't like to be accused of being one. Across from her, the seated man said, you have only one life. If you want to live it with Barney instead of me. I don't, she glared at him. I'm going, Barney said. He opened the hall door. It was hopeless. Wait, Palmer Eldritch rose and sauntered after him. I'll walk downstairs with you. Together, the two of them trudged down the hall toward the steps. Don't give up, Eldritch said. Remember, this is only the initial time you've made use of Choosy. You'll have other times later. You can keep chipping away until eventually you get it. Barney said, what the hell is Choosy? From close behind him, a girl's voice was repeating, Barney Meyerson, come on! He was being shaken. He blinked, squinted. Kneeling, her hand on his shoulder, was Anne Hawthorne. What was it like? I stopped by and I couldn't find anyone around. Then I ran across all of you here in a circle, completely passed out. What if I had been a UN official? You woke me, he said to Anne, realizing what she had done. He felt massive, resentful disappointment. However, the translation for the time being was over, and that was that. But he experienced the craving within him, the yearning, to do it again, and as soon as possible. Everything else was unimportant, even the girl beside him, and his inert, very quiet fellow hovelists slumped here and there. It was that good, Anne said perceptively. She touched her coat. He visited our hovel, too. I bought. The man with the strange teeth and eyes, that gray big man. Eldritch, or a simulacrum of him. His joints ached, as if he had been sitting doubled up for hours, and yet, examining his watch, he saw that only a few seconds, a minute at the most, had passed. Eldritch is everywhere, he said to Anne. Give me your Choosy, he said to her. No. He shrugged, concealing his disappointment, the acute physical impact of deprivation. Well, Palmer Eldritch would be returning. He surely knew the effects of his product, possibly even later today. Tell me about it, Anne said. Barney said, it's an illusory world in which Eldritch holds the key positions as God. He gives you a chance to do what you can't really ever do, reconstruct the past as it ought to have been. But even for him it's hard, takes time. He was silent then. He sat, rubbing his aching forehead. You mean he can't and you can't just wave your arms and get what you want, as you can in a dream? It's absolutely not like a dream. It was worse, he realized, more like being in hell, he thought. Yes, that's the way hell must be, recurrent and unyielding. But Eldritch thought in time, with sufficient patience and effort, it could be changed. If you go back, Anne began. If. He stared at her. I've got to go back. I wasn't able to accomplish anything this time. Hundreds of times, he thought. It might take that. Listen, for God's sake, give me that choosy bindle you've got there. I know I can convince her. I've got Eldritch himself on my side, plugging away. Right now she's mad, and I took her by surprise. He became silent. He stared at Anne Hawthorne. There's something wrong, he thought. Because Anne had one artificial arm and hand. The plastic and metal fingers were only inches from him, and he could discern them clearly. And when he looked up into her face, he saw the hollowness, the emptiness as vast as the intersystem space out of which Eldritch had emerged. The dead eyes, filled with space beyond the known visited world. You can have more later, Anne said calmly. One session a day is enough. She smiled. Otherwise, you'd run out of skins. You wouldn't be able to afford any more. And then what the hell would you do? Her smile glinted, the shiny opulence of stainless steel. The other hovelists, on all sides of him, groaned into wakefulness, recovering by slow, anguished stages. They sat up, mumbled, and tried to orient themselves. Anne had gone somewhere. By himself, he managed to get to his feet. Coffee, he thought. I'll bet she's fixing coffee. Wow, Norm Schein said. Where'd you go? Todd Morris demanded, thick-tongued. Blearily, he too stood, then assisted his wife Helen. I was back in my teens in high school, when I was on my first complete date. First, you get me successful one. You follow? He glanced nervously at Helen then. Mary Regan said, it's much better than candy, infinitely. Oh, if I could tell you what I was doing. She giggled self-consciously. I just can't, though. Her face shone hot and red. Going off to his own compartment, Barney Meyerson locked the door and got out the tube of toxin that Alan Fane had given him. He held it in his hand, thinking, now is the time. But are we back? Did I see nothing more than a residual view of Eldritch superimposed on Anne? Or perhaps it had been genuine insight, perception of the actual, of their unqualified situation, not just his, but all of theirs together. If so, it was not the time to receive the toxin. Instinct offered him that point of observation. Nevertheless, he unscrewed the lid of the tube. A tiny, frail voice emanating from the open tube piped, "You're being watched, Meyerson. And if you're up to some kind of tactic, we'll be required to step in. You will be severely restricted. Sorry." He put the lid back on the tube and screwed it tight with shaking fingers. And the tube had been empty. "What is it?" Anne said, appearing. She had been in the kitchen of his compartment. She wore an apron, which she had discovered somewhere. "What's that?" she asked, seeing the tube in his hand. "Escape," he grated, "from this." "From exactly what?" Her normal appearance had reasserted itself. Nothing now was amiss. "You look positively sick, Barney. You really do. Is it an after effect of the choosy?" "A hangover." "Is Palmer Eldritch actually inside this?" he wondered, examining the closed tube. He revolved it in the palm of his hand. "Is there any way to contact the Fane satellite?" "Oh, I imagine so. You probably just put in a vid call or whatever their means of..." "Go ask Norm Schein to make the contact for me," he said. Obligingly, Anne departed, the compartment door shut after her. At once, he dug the code book which Fane had presented him from its hiding place beneath the kitchen stove. This would have to be encoded. The pages of the code book were blank. "Then it won't go in code," he said to himself, "and that's that. I'll have to do the best I can and let it go, however unsatisfactory." The door swung open. Anne appeared and said, "Mr. Shine is placing the call for you. They request particular tunes all the time, he says." He followed her down the corridor and into a cramped little room where Norm sat at a transmitter. As Barney entered, he turned his head and said, "I've got Charlotte. Will that do?" "Alan," Barney said. "Okay." Presently, Norm said, "Now I've got old eggplant, Al. Here." He handed the microphone to Barney. On the tiny screen, Alan Fane's face, jovial and professional, appeared. "A new citizen to talk to you," Norm explained, reclutching the microphone briefly. "Barney Myerson, meet half of the team that keeps us alive and sane here on Mars." To himself, he muttered, "God, have I got a headache. Excuse me." He vacated the chair at the transmitter and disappeared totteringly down the hall. "Mr. Fane," Barney said carefully, "I was speaking with Mr. Palmer Eldritch earlier today. He mentioned the conversation that you and I had." "He was aware of it, so far as I can see. There's no..." Coldly, Alan Fane said, "What conversation?" For an interval, Barney was silent. "Evidently they had an infrared camera going," he continued at last, "probably in a satellite that was making its pass. However, the contents of our conversation, it would appear, is still not..." "You're a nut," Fane said. "I don't know you. I never had any conversation with you." "Well, man, have you a request or not?" His face was impassive, oblique with detachment, and it did not seem simulated. "You don't know who I am?" Barney said unbelievingly. Fane cut the connection at his end, and the tiny vid screen fused over, now showing only emptiness, the void. Barney shut off the transmitter. He felt nothing, apathy. He walked past Anne and out into the corridor. There he halted, got out his package, was it the last, of Terran cigarettes, and lit up, thinking, what Eldritch did to Leo on Luna, or Sigma 14B, or wherever, he's done to me, too. And eventually he'll snare us all, just like this, isolated. The communal world is gone. At least for me. He began with me. And he thought, I'm supposed to fight back with an empty tube that once may or may not have contained a rare, expensive, brain-disorganizing toxin, but which now contains only Palmer Eldritch, and not even all of him, just his voice. The match burned his fingers. He ignored it. 11. Referring to his bundle of notes, Felix Blau stated, 15 hours ago, a UN-approved, choosy-owned ship landed on Mars and distributed its initial bindles to the Hovels in the Feinberg Crescent. Leo Bolero leaned toward the screen, folded his hands, and said, including chickenpox prospects? Briefly, Felix nodded. By now, Leo said, he should have consumed the dose of that brain-rotting filth, and we should have heard from him via the satellite system. I fully realize that. William C. Clark is still standing by. Clark was P.P. Layout's top legal man on Mars. Yes, Felix said. But Myerson hasn't contacted him either. He hasn't contacted anybody. He shoved his documents aside. That is all, absolutely all, I have at this point. Maybe he died, Leo said. He felt morose. The whole thing depressed him. Maybe he had such a severe convulsion that... But then we'd have heard, because one of the three UN hospitals on Mars would have been notified. Where is Palmer Eldritch? No one in my organization knows, Felix said. He left Luna and disappeared. We simply lost him. I'd give my right arm, Leo said, to know what's going on down in that hovel, that chicken pox prospect where Barney is. Go to Mars yourself. Oh, no, Leo said at once. I'm not leaving PP Layouts, not after what happened to me on Muna. Can't you get a man in there from your organization who can report directly to us? We have that girl, that Anne Hawthorne, but she hasn't checked in either. Maybe I'll go to Mars if you're not. I'm not, Leo repeated. Felix Blau said, it'll cost you. Sure, Leo said, and I'll pay. But at least we'll have some sort of chance. I mean, as it stands, we've got nothing. And we're finished, he said to himself. Just bill me, he said. But do you have any idea what it would cost you if I died? If they got me there on Mars? My organization would please, Leo said. I don't want to talk about that. What is Mars? A graveyard that Eldritch is digging? Eldritch probably ate Barney Meyerson. Okay, you go. You show up at Chicken Pox Prospects. He rang off. Behind him, Ronnie Fugate, his acting New York pre-fash consultant, sat intently listening. Taking it all in, Leo said to himself. Did you get a good earful? He demanded roughly. Ronnie said, you're doing the same thing to him that he did to you. Who? What? Barney was afraid to follow you when you disappeared on Muna. Now you're afraid. It's just not wise. All right, he said. I'm too goddamn scared of Palmer to set foot outside this building. Of course I'm not going to Mars, and what you say is absolutely true. But no one, Ronnie said softly, is going to fire you the way you did Barney. I'm firing myself. Inside, it hurts. But not enough to make you go to Mars. All right. Savagely, he snapped the vidset back on again and dialed Felix Blau. Blau, I take it all back. I'm going myself, although it's insane. Frankly, Felix Blau said, in my opinion, you're doing exactly what Palmer Eldritch wants. All questions of bravery versus... Eldritch's power works through that drug, Leo said. As long as he can't administer any to me, I'm fine. I'll take a few company guards along to watch that I'm not slipped an injection like last time. Hey, Blau, you still come along, okay? He swung to face Ronnie. Is that all right? Yes, she nodded. See, she says it's okay. So, will you come along with me to Mars and, you know, hold my hand? Sure, Leo. Felix Blau said. And if you faint, I'll fan you back to consciousness. I'll meet you at your office in... He examined his wristwatch. 2 hours. We'll map out details. Have a fast ship ready. And I'll bring a couple of men along I have confidence in, too. That's it, Leo said to Ronnie as he broke the connection. Look what you got me to do. You seized Barney's job, and if I don't get back from Mars... Maybe you can nail down my job, too. He glared at her. Women can get a man to do anything, he realized. Mother, wife, even employee. They twist us like hot little bits of thermoplastic. Ronnie said, is that really why I said it, Mr. Bolero? Do you really believe that? He took a good, long, hard look at her. Yes, because you're insatiably ambitious. I really believe that. You're wrong. If I don't come back from Mars, will you come after me? He waited, but she did not answer. He saw hesitation on her face, and at that he loudly laughed. Of course not, he said. Stonily, Ronnie Fugate said, I must get back to my office. I have new flatware to judge. Modern patterns from Cape Town. Rising, she departed. He watched her go, thinking, she's the real one, not Palmer Eldritch. If I do get back, I've got to find some method of quietly dumping her. I don't like to be manipulated. Palmer Eldritch, he thought suddenly, appeared in the form of a small girl, a little child, not to mention later on, when he was that dog. Maybe there is no Ronnie Fugate. Maybe it's Eldritch. The thought chilled him. What we have here, he realized, is not an invasion of Earth by proxmen, beings from another system. Not an invasion by the legions of a pseudo-human race. No, It's Palmer Eldritch who's everywhere, growing and growing like a mad weed. Is there a point where he'll burst, grow too much? All the manifestations of Eldritch all over Terra and Luna and Mars. Palmer puffing up and bursting. Pop, pop, pop. Like Shakespeare says, some damn thing about sticking a mere pin in through the armor and goodbye, King. But, he thought, what in this case is the pin? And is there an open spot into which we can thrust it? I don't know. And Felix doesn't know. And Barney. I'll make book that he doesn't have the foggiest idea of how to cope with Eldritch. Kidnap Zoe, the man's elderly, ugly daughter? Palmer wouldn't care. Unless Palmer is also Zoe. Maybe there is no Zoe, independent of him. And that's the way we'll all wind up unless we figure out how to destroy him, he realized. Replicas, extensions of the man, inhabiting 3 planets and 6 moons. The man's a protoplasm, spreading and reproducing and dividing, and all through that damn lichen-derived non-Terran drug, that horrible, miserable choosy. Once more at the vidset, he dialed Alan Fane's satellite. Presently, a trifle insubstantial and weak, but nevertheless there, the face of his prime disc jockey appeared. Yes, Mr. Bolero. You're positive Meyerson hasn't contacted you. He's got the code book, hasn't he? Got the book, but still nothing from him. We've been monitoring every transmission from Chickenpox Prospects. We saw Eldritch's ship land near the Hovel. That was hours ago. And we saw Eldritch get out and go up to the Hovelist. And although our cameras didn't pick this up, I'm sure the transaction was consummated at that instant. Fane added, and Barney Meyerson was one of the Hovelists who met Eldritch at the surface. I believe I know what happened, Leo said. Okay, thanks, Al. He rang off. Barney went below with a choosy, he realized, and right away they all sat down and chewed. That was the end, just as it was for me on Luna. Our tactics required that Barney chew away, Leo realized, and so we played right into Palmer's dirty, semi-mechanical hands. Once he had the drug in Barney's system, we were through, because Eldritch somehow controls each of the hallucinatory worlds induced by the drug. I know it, that the skunk is in all of them. The fantasy worlds that Choosy induces, he thought, are in Palmer Eldritch's head. As I found out personally. And the trouble is, he thought, that once you get into one of them, you can't quite scramble back out. It stays with you, even when you think you're free. It's a one-way gate, and for all I know, I'm still in it now. However, that did not seem likely. And yet, he thought, it shows how afraid I am, as Ronnie Fugue pointed out. Afraid enough to, I'll admit it, abandon Barney there like he abandoned me. And Barney was using his precog ability, so he had foresight, almost to the point where it was like what I have now, like hindsight. He knew in advance what I had to learn by experience. No wonder he balked. Who gets sacrificed? Leo asked himself. Me, Barney, Felix Blau. Which of us gets melted down for Palmer to guzzle? Because that's what we are, potentially, for him, food to be consumed. It's an oral thing that arrived back from the Prox system, a great mouth, open to receive us. But Palmer's not a cannibal, because I know he's not human. That's not a man there in that Palmer Eldritch skin. But what it was, he had no concept at all. So much could happen in the vast expanses between Sol and Proxima, either going or coming. Maybe it happened, he thought, when Palmer was going. Maybe he ate the Proxmen during those 10 years, cleaned the plate there, and so then came back to us. Ugh, he shivered. Well, he thought, 2 more hours of independent life, plus the time it takes to travel to Mars. Maybe 10 hours of private existence. And then swallowed. And all over Mars, that hideous drug is being distributed. Think, picture, the numbers confined to Palmer's illusory worlds, his nets that he cast. What do those Buddhists in the UN, like Hepburn Gilbert, call it? Maya? The veil of illusion. Shoot, he thought dismally, and reached to snap on his intercom in order to requisition a fast ship for the flight. And I want a good pilot, he remembered. Too many autonomic landings of late have been failures. I don't intend to be splattered all over the countryside, especially that countryside. To Miss Gleason, he said, who's the best interplan pilot we have? Don Davis, Miss Gleason said promptly. He has a perfect record in, you know, his flights from Venus. She did not refer explicitly to their Can-D enterprise. Even the intercom might be tapped. 10 minutes later, the travel arrangements had all been made. Leo Bolero leaned back in his chair, lit a large green Havana Leaf Claro cigar, which had been housed in a helium-filled humidor, probably for years. The cigar, as he bit the end off, seemed dry and brittle. It cracked under the pressure of his teeth, and he felt disappointment. It had appeared so good, so perfectly preserved in its coffin. Well, you never know, he informed himself, until you get right to it. His office door opened. Miss Gleason, the ship requisition papers in her hands, entered. The hand which held the papers was artificial. He made out the glint of undisguised metal, and at once he raised his head to scrutinize her face, the rest of her. Neanderthal teeth, he thought. That's what those giant stainless steel molars look like. Reversion. 200,000 years back. Revolting. And the Luxvid or Vidlux or whatever they were, eyes without pupils, only slits. Jensen Labs of Chicago's product, anyhow. God damn you, Eldritch, he said. I'm your pilot, too, Palmer Eldritch, from within the shape of Miss Gleason, said. And I was thinking of greeting you when you land. But that's too much, too soon. Give me the papers to sign, Leo said, reaching out. Surprised, Palmer Eldritch said, you still intend to make the trip to Mars? He looked decidedly taken aback. Yes, Leo said, and waited patiently for the requisition papers. Once you've taken Choosy, you're delivered over. At least, that's how dogmatic, devout, fanatical Anne Hawthorne would phrase it. Like sin, Barney Meyerson thought, it is the condition of slavery, like the fall. And the temptation is similar. But what's missing here is a way by which we can be freed. Would we have to go to Prox to find it? Even there it may not exist, not in the universe, anywhere. Anne Hawthorne appeared at the door of the Hubble's transmitter room. Are you all right? Sure, Barney said. You know, we got ourselves into this. No one made us choose. He dropped his cigarette to the floor and erased its life with the toe of his boot. And you won't give me your bindle, he said. But it was not Anne denying it to him. It was Palmer Eldritch operating through her, holding back. Even so, I can take it from her, he realized. Stop, she said, or rather, it said. Hey, Norm Schein yelled from the transmitter room, jumping to his feet, amazed. What are you doing, Meyerson? Let her... The strong artificial arm struck him. The metal fingers clawed, and it was almost enough. They pried at his neck, knowingly, alert to the spot where death could most effectively be administered. But he had the bindle, and that was it. He let the creature go. Don't take it, Barney, she said quietly. It's just too soon after the first dose. Please. Without answering, he started off toward his own compartment. Will you do one thing for me? She called after him. Divide it in half. Let me take it with you, so I can be along. Why? He said. Maybe I can help you by being there. Barney said, I can make it on my own. If I can reach Emily before the divorce, before Richard Natt shows up as I first did, he thought. That's the only place I have any real chance. Again and again, he thought. Try until I'm successful. He locked the door. As he devoured the choosy, he thought about Leo Bolero. You got away. Probably because Palmer Eldritch was weaker than you, is that it? Or was Eldritch simply paying out the line, letting you dangle? You could come here and stop me. Now, though, there's no stopping. Even Eldritch warned me, speaking through Anne Hawthorne. It was too much even for him, and now what? Have I gone so far that I've plunged to the bottom out of even his sight, where even Palmer Eldritch can't go, where nothing exists? And of course, he thought, I can't get back up. His head ached, and he shut his eyes involuntarily. It was as if his brain, alive and frightened, had physically stirred. He felt it tremble. Altered metabolism, he realized. Shock. I'm sorry, he said to himself, apologizing to his somatic part. Okay? Help, he said aloud. Ah, help my ass, a man's voice grated. What do you want me to do? Hold your hand? Open your eyes or get out of here. That period you spent on Mars, it ruined you, and I'm fed up. Come on. Shut up, Barney said. I'm sick. I went too far. You mean all you can do is bawl me out? He opened his eyes and faced Leo Bolero, who was at his big, littered oak desk. Listen, Barney said. I'm on Chu Z. I can't stop it. If you can't help me, then I'm finished. His legs bent as if melting as he made his way to a nearby chair and seated himself. Regarding him thoughtfully, smoking a cigar, Leo said, You're on Chu Z now, he scowled. As of 2 years ago. It's banned? Yeah, banned. My God, I don't know if it's worth my talking to you. What are you, some kind of phantasm from the past? You heard what I said. I said I'm on it. He clenched his fists. Okay, okay. Leo puffed masses of heavy gray smoke agitatedly. Don't get excited. Hell, I went ahead and saw the future too, and it didn't kill me. And anyhow, for Christ's sakes, you're a precog. You ought to be used to it. Anyhow, he leaned back in his chair, swiveled about, then crossed his legs. I saw this monument, see? Guess to who? To me. He eyed Barney, then shrugged. Barney said, I have nothing to gain, nothing at all from this time period. I want my wife back. I want Emily. He felt enraged, upsurging bitterness, the bile of disappointment. Emily, Leo Bolero nodded. Then into his intercom, he said, Miss Gleason, please don't let anything bother us for a while. He again turned his attention to Barney, surveying him acutely. That fellow, Nat, is that his name? Got hauled in by the UN police along with the rest of the Eldritch organization. See, Nat had this contract that he signed with Eldritch's business agent. Well, they gave him the choice of a prison sentence. Okay, I admit it's unfair, but don't blame me. Or emigrating. He emigrated. What about her? With that pot business of hers, how the hell could she conduct it from a hovel underneath the Martian desert? Naturally, she dumped the dumb jerk. Well, so see if you had waited. Barney said, Are you really Leo Bolero? Or are you Palmer Eldritch? And this is to make me feel even worse, is that it? Raising an eyebrow, Leo said, Palmer Eldritch is dead. But this isn't real. This is a drug-induced fantasy. Translation. The hell it isn't real, Leo glared at him. What does that make me, then? Listen, he pointed his finger angrily at Barney. There's nothing unreal about me. You're the one who's a goddamn phantasm, like you said, out of the past. I mean, you've got the situation completely backward. You hear this? He banged on the surface of his desk with all the strength in his hands. The sound reality makes. And I say that your ex-wife and Nat are divorced. I know because she sells her pots to us for minning. In fact, she was in Ronnie Fugate's office last Thursday. Grumpily, he smoked his cigar, still glaring at Barney. Then all I have to do, Barney said, is look her up. It was as simple as that. Oh, yeah, Leo agreed, nodding. But just one thing. What are you going to do with Ronnie Fugate? You're living with her in this world that you seem to like to imagine is unreal. Astounded, Barney said, after 2 years? And Emily knows it because since she's been selling her parts to us through Ronnie, the two of them have become buddies. They tell each other their secrets. Look at it from Emily's viewpoint. If she lets you come back to her, Ronnie will probably stop accepting her parts for Minning. It's a risk, and I bet Em won't want to take it. I mean, we give Ronnie absolute say-so, like you had in your time. Barney said, Emily would never put her career ahead of her own life. You did. Maybe Em learned from you, got the message. And anyhow, even without that Nat guy, why would Emily want to go back to you? She's leading a very successful life with her career, she's planet famous, and she's got skin after skin salted away. You want the truth? She's got all the men she wants, any darn time. Em doesn't need you. Face it, Barney. Anyhow, what's lacking about Ronnie? Frankly, I wouldn't mind. I think you're Palmer Eldritch, Barney said. Me? Leo tapped his chest. Barney, I killed Eldritch. That's why they put up that monument to me. His voice was low and quiet, but he had flushed deep red. Do I have stainless steel teeth? I have an artificial arm? Leo lifted up both his hands. Well, and my eyes. Barney moved toward the door of the office. Where are you going? Leo demanded. I know, Barney said as he opened the door, that if I can see Emily, even for just a few minutes... No, you can't, fella, Leo said. He shook his head firmly. Waiting in the corridor for the elevator, Barney thought, maybe it really was Leo, and maybe it's true. So I cannot succeed without Palmer Eldritch. Anne was right. I should have given half the bindle back to her, and then we could have tried this together. Anne, Palmer, it's all the same. It's all him, the creator. That's who and what he is, he realized, the owner of these worlds. The rest of us just inhabit them, and when he wants to, he can inhabit them too, can kick over the scenery, manifest himself, push things in any direction he chooses, even be any of us he cares to. All of us, in fact, if he desires. Eternal, outside of time and spliced together segments of all other dimensions, he can even enter a world in which he's dead. Palmer Eldritch had gone to Prox a man and returned a god. Aloud, as he stood waiting for the elevator, Barney said, Palmer Eldritch, help me. Get my wife back for me. He looked around. No one was present to overhear him. The elevator arrived. The door slid aside. Inside the elevator waited 4 men and 2 women, silently. All of them were Palmer Eldritch. Men and women alike, artificial arms, stainless steel teeth, the gaunt, hollowed-out gray face with Jensen eyes. Virtually in unison, but not quite, as if competing with each other for first chance to utter it, the 6 people said, You're not going to be able to get back to your own world from here, Meyerson. You've gone too far this time, taken a massive overdose. As I warned you when you snatched it away from me at Chicken Pox Prospect. Can't you help me? Barney said. I've got to get her back. You don't understand, the Palmer Eldritches all said, collectively shaking their heads. It was the same motion that Leo had just now made, and the same firm no. As we pointed out to you, since this is your future, you're already established here. So there's no place for you. That's a matter of simple logic. Who am I supposed to snare Emily for? You? Or the legitimate Barney Meyerson who lived naturally up to this time. And don't think he hasn't tried to get Emily back. Don't you suppose, and obviously you haven't, that as the Nats split up, he made his move? I did what I could for him then. It was quite a few months ago, just after Richard Nat was shipped to Mars, kicking and protesting the whole way. Personally, I don't blame Nat. It was a dirty deal, all engineered by Leo, of course. And look at yourself. The 6 Palmer Eldritches gestured contemptuously. You're a phantasm, as Leo said. I can see through you, literally. I'll tell you in more accurate terminology what you are. From the six, the calm, dispassionate statement came then. You're a ghost. Barney stared at them, and they stared back placidly, unmoved. Try building your life on that premise, the Eldritches continued. Well, you got what St. Paul promises, as Anne Hawthorne was blabbing about. You're no longer clothed in a perishable fleshly body. You've put on an ethereal body in its place. How do you like it, Meyerson? Their tone was mocking, but compassion showed on the six faces. It showed in the weird, slitted, mechanical eyes of each of them. You can't die. You don't eat or drink or breathe air. You can, if you wish, pass directly through walls. In fact, through any material object you care to. You'll learn that in time. Evidently on the road to Damascus, Paul experienced a vision relating to this phenomenon. That, and a lot more besides. The Eldritches added, I'm inclined, as you can see, to be somewhat sympathetic to the early and neo-Christian point of view, such as Anne holds. It assists in explaining a great deal. Barney said, What about you, Eldritch? You're dead, killed 2 years ago by Leo. And I know he thought that you're suffering what I am. The same process must have overtaken you somewhere along the route. You gave yourself an overdose of choosy, and now for you there's no return to your own time and world either. That monument, the six Eldritches said, murmuring together like a rattling far-off wind, is highly inaccurate. The ship of mine had a running gun battle with one of Leo's just off Venus. I was aboard, or supposed to be aboard, ours. Leo was aboard his. He and I had just held a conference together with Hepburn Gilbert on Venus, and on the way back to Terra, Leo took the opportunity to jump our ship. It's on that premise that the monument was erected, due to Leo's astute economic pressure applied in all the proper political bodies. He got himself into the history books once and for all. Two persons, a well-dressed executive-type young man and a girl who was possibly a secretary, strolled down the hall. They glanced curiously at Barney and then at the six creatures within the elevator. The creatures ceased to be Palmer Eldritch. The change took place before him. All at once they were six individual, ordinary men and women, utterly heterogeneous. Barney walked away from the elevator. For a measureless interval, he roamed the corridors and then by ramp descended to ground level where the PP layout's directory was situated. There, reading it, he located his own name and office number. Ironically, and this bordered on being just too much, he held the title he had tried to pry by force out of Leo not so long ago. He was listed as pre-fash supervisor, clearly outranking every individual consultant. So again, if he had only waited. Beyond doubt, Leo had managed to bring him back from Mars, rescued him from the world of the hovel, and this implied a great deal. The planned litigation, or some substitute tactic, had succeeded, would rather, and perhaps soon. The mist of hallucination cast up by Palmer Eldritch, the fisherman of human souls, was enormously effective, but not perfect, not in the long run. So had he stopped consuming Choosy after the initial dose. Perhaps Anne Hawthorne's possession of a bindle had been deliberate, a means of maneuvering him into taking it once again and very quickly. If so, her protests had been spurious. She had intended that he seize it, and like a beast in a superior maze, he had scrambled for the glimpsed way out, manipulated by Palmer Eldritch through every inch of the way, and there was no path back. If he was to believe Eldritch, speaking through Leo, through his congregation everywhere. But that was the key word, if. By elevator, he ascended to the floor of his own office. When he opened the office door, the man seated at the desk raised his head and said, Close that thing. We don't have a lot of time. The man, and it was himself, rose. Barney scrutinized him and then reflexively shut the door as instructed. Thanks. His future self said icily, and stop worrying about getting back to your own time, you will. Most of what Eldritch did, or does, if you prefer to regard it that way, consists of manufacturing surface changes. He makes things appear the way he wants, but that doesn't mean they are. Follow me? I'll take your word for it. His future self said, I realize that's easy for me to say now. Eldritch still shows up from time to time, sometimes even publicly. But I know, and everyone else, right down to the most ignorant readers of the lowest level of papes know, that it's nothing but a phantasm. The actual man is in a grave on Sigma 14B, and that's verified. You're in a different spot. For you, the actual Palmer Eldritch could enter at any minute. What would be actual for you would be a phantasm for me. And the same is going to be true when you get back to Mars. You'll be encountering a genuine living Palmer Eldritch, and I don't frankly envy you. Barney said, just tell me how to get back. You don't care about Emily anymore? I'm scared. And he felt his own gaze, the perception and comprehension of the future, fear him. Okay, he blurted. What am I supposed to do? Pretend otherwise to impress you? Anyhow, you'd know. Where Eldritch had the advantage over everyone and anyone who's consumed Choose Z is that recovery from the drug is excessively retarded and gradual. It's a series of levels, each progressively less an induced illusion and more compounded of authentic reality. Sometimes the process takes years. This is why the UN belatedly banned it and turned against Eldritch. Hepburn Gilbert initially approved it because he honestly believed that it aided the user to penetrate to concrete reality. And then it became obvious to everyone who used it or witnessed it being used that it did exactly the... Then I never recovered from my first dose. Right. You never got back to clear-cut reality, as you would have if you had abstained another 24 hours. Those phantasms of Eldritch imposed on normal matter would have faded away entirely. You would have been free. But Eldritch got you to accept that second, stronger dose. He knew you had been sent to Mars to operate against him, although he didn't have any idea in what way. He was afraid of you. It sounded strange to hear that. It did not ring right. Eldritch, with all he had done and could do, but Eldritch had seen the monument of the future. He knew that somehow, in some manner, they were going to kill him after all. The door of the office abruptly opened. Ronnie Fugate looked in and saw the two of them. She said nothing. She simply stared open-mouthed. And then at last murmured, "A phantasm. I think it's the one standing, the one nearest me." Shakily, she entered the office, shutting the door after her. "That's right," his future self said, scrutinizing her sharply. "You can test it out by putting your hand into it." She did so. Barney Meyerson saw her hand pass into his body and disappear. "I've seen phantasms before," she said, withdrawing her hand. Now she was more composed. "But never of you, dear. Everyone who consumed that abomination became a phantasm at one time or another, but recently they've become less frequent to us. At one time, about a year ago, you saw them every time you turned around." She added, "Hepburn Gilbert finally saw one of himself, just what he deserved." "You realize," his future self said to Ronnie, "that he's under the domination of Eldritch, even though to us the man is dead. So we have to work cautiously. Eldritch can begin to affect his perception at any time, and when that happens, he'll have no choice but to react accordingly." Speaking to Barney, Ronnie said, "What can we do for you?" "He wants to get back to Mars," his future self said. "They've got an enormously complicated scheme screwed together to destroy Eldritch via the Interplan courts. It involves him taking an Ionian epilepsygenic, KV-7. Or can't you remember back to that?" "But it never got into the courts," Ronnie said. "Eldritch settled. They dropped litigation." "We can transport you to Mars," his future self said to Barney, "in a PP layout ship. But that won't accomplish anything, because Eldritch will not only follow you and be with you on the trip, he'll be there to greet you, a favorite outdoor sport of his. Never forget that a phantasm can go anywhere. It's not bounded by time or space. That's what makes it a phantasm. That, and the fact that it has no metabolism, at least not as we understand the word." Oddly, however, it is affected by gravity. There have been a number of studies lately on the subject. Anyhow, not much is yet known. Meaningfully, he finished, especially on the subtopic, how does one return a phantasm to its own space and time? Exorcise it. Barney said, "You're anxious to get rid of me?" He felt cold. "That's right," his future self said calmly. "Just as anxious as you are to get back. You know now you made a mistake. You know that..." He glanced at Ronnie and immediately ceased. He did not intend to refer to the topic of Emily in front of her. "They've made some attempts with high-voltage, low-amperage electroshock," Ronnie said. "And with magnetic fields. Columbia University has..." "The best work so far," his future self said, "is in the physics department of Cal out on the West Coast. The phantasm is bombarded by beta particles, which disintegrate the essential protein basis for..." "Okay," Barney said. "I'll leave you alone. I'll go to the physics department at Cal and see what they can do." He felt utterly defeated. He had been abandoned even by himself, the ultimate, he thought with impotent wild fury. Christ! "That's strange," Ronnie said. "What's strange?" his future self said, tipping his chair back, folding his arms and regarding her. "You're saying that about Cal," Ronnie said. "As far as I know, they've never done any work with phantasms out there." To Barney, she said quietly, "Ask to see both his hands." Barney said, "Your hands." But already the creeping alteration in the seated man had begun, in the jaw especially, the idiosyncratic bulge which he recognized so easily. "Forget it," he said thickly. He felt dizzy. His future self said mockingly, "God helps those who help themselves, Myerson." "Do you really think it's going to do any good to go knocking all around, trying to dream up someone to take pity on you? Hell, I pity you. I told you not to consume that second bindle. I'd release you from this if I knew how, and I know more about the drug than anyone else alive." "What's going to happen to him?" Ronnie asked his future self, which was no longer his future self. The metamorphosis was complete, and Palmer Eldritch sat, tilted back at the desk, tall and gray, rocking slightly in the wheeled chair, a great mass of timeless cobwebs shaped almost as a cavalier gesture in quasi-human form. "My good God, is he just going to wander around here forever?" "Good question," Palmer Eldritch said gravely. "I wish I knew, for myself as well as him. I'm in it a lot deeper than he, remember?" Addressing Barney, he said, "You grasp the point, don't you, that it isn't necessary for you to assume your normal gestalt. You can be a stone, or a tree, or a jet hopper, or a section of anti-thermal roofing. I've been all those things and a lot more. If you become inanimate, an old log, for instance, you're no longer conscious of the passage of time. It's an interesting possible solution for someone who wants to escape his phantasmic existence. I don't." His voice was low. "Because for me, returning to my own space and time means death, at Leo Bolero's instigation. On the contrary, I can live on only in this state. But with you," he gestured, smiling faintly, "be a rock, Myerson. Last it out, however long it is before the drug wears off. 10 years, a century, a million years. Or be an old fossil bone in the museum." His gaze was gentle. After a time, Ronnie said, "Maybe he's right, Barney." Barney walked to the desk, picked up a glass paperweight, and then set it down. "We can't touch him," Ronnie said, "but he can..." "The ability of phantasms to manipulate material objects," Palmer Eldritch said, "makes it clear that they are present and not merely projections. Remember the poltergeist phenomenon. They were capable of hurling objects all around the house, but they were incorporeal too." Mounted on the wall of the office gleamed a plaque. It was an award which Emily had received 3 years before his own time. For ceramics, she had entered in a show. Here it was. He still kept it. I want to be that plaque, Barney decided. It was made of hardwood, probably mahogany, and brass. It would endure a long time, and in addition, he knew that his future self would never abandon it. He walked toward the plaque, wondering how he ceased being a man and became an object of brass and wood mounted on an office wall. Palmer Eldritch said, "You want my help, Myerson?" "Yes," he said. Something swept him up. He put out his arms to steady himself, and then he was diving, descending an endless tunnel that narrowed. He felt it squeeze around him, and he knew that he had misjudged. Palmer Eldritch had once more thought rings around him, demonstrated his power over everyone who used Choose E. Eldritch had done something, and he could not even tell what. But anyhow, it was not what he had said, not what had been promised. "God damn you, Eldritch," Barney said, not hearing his voice, hearing nothing. He descended on and on, weightless, not even a phantasm any longer. Gravity had ceased to affect him, so even that was gone, too. End of side 5. To continue, turn the cassette over.